From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. University of Oklahoma Professor Katerina Tsatsura traveled to Ukraine this summer to learn about civil society engagement.
It's a very small group of activists right now, but I think they're very energetic and they very much want to build up. And that's how usually civic engagement and civil society starts building. And when you have a small group of individuals who are really passionate about the cause.
I'll talk with Tsatsura about Ukraine and the conflict with Russia on today's show. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss the expulsion of an American nonprofit from Cambodia and electoral outcomes in Angola.
The new president is walking into a very difficult situation. Oil prices are down. Angola has been in a lot of economic trouble recently, so he's got a lot of work ahead of him.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about electoral politics. We're spending a lot of time on elections lately, but let's talk about Cambodia. There are actually elections next year in Cambodia that are really important in terms of challenging long-standing ruling parties there in Cambodia. But this week, we did hear some interesting news about the staff of a U.S.-based nonprofit, the National Democratic Institute, was expelled from Cambodia. The foreign minister announced that they needed to leave the country within a week because they are there providing training to Cambodian political parties, which does, of course, include opposition parties to the main ruling party that's been in power for, like I said, 30 years. So give us kind of the scenario here of what we're seeing happening in Cambodia regarding what we might actually be seeing happening with elections in the next year or so.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. The National Democratic Institute, as you said, this is an organization that promotes democracy really around the world, but has been doing that in Cambodia. And the theory is that the prime minister is a little nervous about the upcoming election, that the opposition is gaining momentum, and that this is perhaps a group that has been aiding them. And so he has actually been taking a number of steps to not just push away international groups, but other civil society groups, to curtail freedom of the press. He has a somewhat interesting is that he has actually been a supporter of President Trump and has been on CNN touting how correct President Trump was to criticize the role of the media and CNN in particular. And now the Trump administration is actually very upset that this organization has been pushed out. So kind of an interesting thing there. But there are questions about how democratic or the country is, what these elections are going to be, how free and fair they are as he continues to curtail some of this stuff. And, this is an interesting situation. They're talking about a return to violence, perhaps. The 1970s, obviously, a very difficult time in that country. There are political leaders, the prime minister being one, that really is alluding to the fact that the United States has gotten over-involved, reminding everyone of the role that they played in the lead-up to the Khmer Rouge, which was considered by many a genocide. And so a war of words that's going on here between the United States and Cambodia. And these people will be leaving here soon, apparently.
Well, let's switch to another continent. Let's talk about Angola. We have some election results, actually, or emerging election results from this week's elections in Angola. Now, there we have a president that's been in power for 38 years, and they are claiming that majority party has claimed victory in this election, kind of paving the way for the defense minister to succeed this president. You know, reports have really been international reports is that it's been generally fair. There have been some intimidation tactics that have been used in this oil rich country. So you see why perhaps, again, in a place like Angola, there's hesitance to give up power when you've held on to power for so long. So give us some sense of what's happening in Angola.
Yeah, Dos Santos, who's been leader, as you mentioned, since 1979, so essentially my entire lifetime, he had decided last year that he was going to step down. The rumor is that this is health-related, so he's stepping down. But his party looks like they're going to take power. But the opposition parties were pretty successful in getting out there. So this is a much more contentious election than they've seen previously. But Dos Santos is a bit of an icon there. He was involved early on in the push for independence. They only got their independence in 1975 from Portugal. And almost immediately, this resulted in a civil war that kind of went back and forth until 2002. So really somewhat recently, he's stepping down. But the idea is that he's going to still retain quite a bit of influence, perhaps some power. As you said, it looks like things were fairly okay, but there was an interesting issue with the EU was going to send electoral advisors or observers in. However, they ended up not doing that because they were going to be so heavily restricted. So we did have electoral observers from other African countries, and they seem to say that for the most part, this looked fairly free and fair. But we'll see. And this the new president is walking into a very difficult situation. Oil prices are down. Angola has been in a lot of economic trouble recently. So he's got a lot of work ahead of him.
Well, again, two important elections to pay attention to. And we will return to this topic undoubtedly in the weeks and months to come. So thank you, Rebecca, for being here today.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or you can like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Guerlat. Next, we'll talk with Katerina Tsatsura for an update on the conflict in Ukraine. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katerina Tsatsura is a professor of public relations and strategic communications at the University of Oklahoma. Originally from Ukraine, Tsatsura's research interests include media transparency and international public relations. She visited Ukraine this summer as part of a consulting team for a USAID fact-finding mission about civil society engagement in the country. Katerina Tsatsura, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me here. And Ukraine's kind of dropped off the front pages lately for the past few years. It was all over the news in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and then the war began in the eastern part of Ukraine. It seems to have kind of been frozen for a little while, although it sounds like things are still happening there. But give us your perception, having been there recently, having come from this country, what is the latest in Ukraine? What can we know about what's happening there with the conflict?
Sure. Even despite the fact that Ukraine has gone from the front pages here in the United States, there is still a lot going on there. And, of course, the conflict by no means is over. The eastern part of Ukraine, which has been battling back and forth, and there are two sides really there, the Russian side and the Ukrainian side that battle each other, is still very much in war zone, and in many ways it's still a very much a conflict that is ongoing, despite the fact that it's not on the news right now. Now, it's very important to emphasize that it's only happening in certain places in the eastern part of Ukraine, and much of Ukraine also is just as detached from that conflict as some neighboring countries.
Can I just clarify one thing, Katerina? When you say there are two sides, okay, so Russia... Are they Russian troops, or are there Ukrainians that are of Russian descent that are supporting kind of maybe breaking away and joining Russia or supporting kind of Russian dominance in the region? Can you kind of clarify that for us? Because I think there's a lot of real understanding about who's actually fighting in this conflict.
It's a really good question, and it's a very difficult question to answer. And I think there are several discourses about this truth. Story of what's happening here, but we can certainly say with some certainty that there are some Russians who come from Russia or Russian speakers who come from Russia and other areas, including Ukraine, who are fighting on, so to call, the Russian side. And the idea is to have this territory of Donetsk and Lugansk as the independent territories from everybody, from Ukraine and from Russia. They are very heavily supported by the Russian government. And that's the idea behind the Russian side, I think. On the other hand, it's the Ukrainian troops, ATO, who are fighting and protecting, really, the land. At this point, they're not necessarily trying to get back Donetsk and Lugansk. They're just trying to keep the front line and protect the Ukrainian-based territories in east. Over the past 12 months or so, there were some territories along the border in eastern Ukraine that were recaptured. So one of those, or among those smaller regional towns of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. And what is happening right now is that there's a very fragile civic engagement and civic development happens in those regions along the border. And there's a lot of interest and a lot of effort that is put there by Ukrainians to really rebuild the life as it has been before in those territories. There's a lot of interesting elements happening there. So, for example, some very small but active group of civil activists who are trying to work with local government and with the government in Ukraine to really kind of rebuild the infrastructure but also rebuild the civil activities and actions. And there are some independent regional media that help development on the eastern side and helping to tell a story of what's happening now in those locations.
I mean, you just mentioned how the Ukrainian forces and government are really, they've kind of ceded the territory. So there's this zone of just, is it Ukraine? Is it Russia? I mean, you know, who does it belong to? And the kind of flood of people that have left, right? That there really aren't, you know, working class people there. So what is life like in this part of the world? I know you've mentioned these very interesting cases of small towns in particular with local activists. So are people trying to take these places back or are they just fleeing?
That's a very good question. I think there's two sides here, or two parts that I would want to emphasize. So there is a territory that is not controlled by Ukraine. So these are the Luhansk and Donetsk territories, and those territories are kind of off the limits. So they have their own government right now that is supported by Russia. Now there is a gray zone, so to speak. The gray zone truly is between those Luhansk and Donetsk territories and the Ukrainian-controlled territory. And people still live there, but there are very few of those. So most of the people left either one for the east or back to Ukraine, and then the Ukrainian territory. But there are lots of IDPs, right, and displaced people in the region, and many people who used to live in Donetsk and Luhansk and chose not to stay there but moved back to Ukraine are now living in these territories along the front line or moved even farther west in Ukraine. And some of them really are not trying to stay, but many of them also came back to the places where they originally were, like Kramatorsk or Slavyansk. We also see a lot of activists in Kramatorsk and Slavyansk who actually have lived in Donetsk before and left and chose to stay with Ukrainians. And those are the people who are now making their new life as IDPs in those locations. And now they're the ones who want to see the activities of civil engagement for the future.
I haven't spent much time in Ukraine, you know, in the past many years, but spent a lot of time there back in the early days of their independence. And one of the things that I recognized was that there was a pretty strong sense of identity of being Ukrainian. There was a pretty strong sense at that time, again, early former Soviet period, of wanting to move away from Russia. We saw that change over time, and particularly with certain leadership in Ukraine and kind of, you know, going back toward the east as perhaps the West wasn't welcoming enough to Ukraine. Maybe they saw the writing on the wall. They weren't going to become EU members or anything like that anytime soon. So how are the Ukrainians handling this situation today? How do they feel about themselves today as Ukrainians? Are those in the East that are now under Russian control really just saying, well, okay, we're just Russians? Or is there still some sense of national identity in Ukraine?
Very good question, and I think the one that really gives us a glimpse into what's happening in Ukraine. I think you're absolutely right that the national identity of Ukrainians has always been around and has been a very strong identity that defined as opposed to Russia or as opposed to somebody else. Right now, we see that that strong national identity of Ukrainians is still very much there. And especially in the last 12 months, we've seen 12 to 24 months, we've seen an increasing interest in having this cohesive national identity, even among the people who live in the East, regardless of the ethnicity. So it really becomes the civic identity, civically defined idea of I am Ukrainian because I belong to this country. And the reason for that, and among others that I have seen and have been talking to the experts in Ukraine just in June, is that a lot of people in the East are now disillusioned with the idea of this frozen conflict. And the longer the conflict continues, the longer people die in the territories there, the more people realize that Russia is not going to come in and help them, and they're not going to support them. And they start looking at the ways of understanding how they can make their lives better. And that's where now, where's, you know, maybe 2 years ago, a lot of people were really disillusioned with the Kyiv government, and they were looking up to Kremlin to help and save them. Now they're just disillusioned with everything and just making a life for themselves in the places where they are. But I do think that there is a bigger sense of the national identity in Ukraine, and it keeps having this idea of cohesion as a very fragile and yet very moldable identity of who you are as a Ukrainian.
Well, on this issue of identity, and I want to follow up on that, but you also mentioned having looked to Russia to help and that they've realized that the Russians aren't going to help them. I mean, who is helping them? And is that perhaps maybe underlying the sense of a greater sense of Ukrainian identity, because nobody else is coming to help them either, right? I mean, if the Russians aren't helping, the U.S. isn't helping, the West isn't helping, there's really no one that's responding to this crisis. So who else do they have to turn to but themselves?
Yes, it's a very good question. I think there are different levels of help that we can talk about. So in some level, we can say nobody is helping. And certainly in the sense of, you know, providing lethal weapons, for example, nobody's helping Ukraine at this point. But I think there are other ways to help that are happening in the region and that we see. And that mostly deals with civic engagement and rebuilding infrastructure. And there are quite a few foundations from the European Union and actually from the United States that are present in the Ukrainian-controlled territories that are not themselves there, but they help financially to support the civic engagement initiatives. So to support NGOs or support leadership and activists who want to do something good for their territories in Ukraine. And this very similar thing in terms of engagement and infrastructure development is happening on the non-Ukrainian controlled territories in Donetsk and Luhansk, where the Russian government is helping to rebuild the roads and to, kind of rebuild these schools and help people find the ways to live their lives again in the territories that are not controlled in Ukraine. And I think you can safely say that these two rebuilding infrastructures, one on the side of Ukrainian-controlled territories and the other one on the non-Ukrainian-controlled territories, are kind of competing against each other, because people who live in those territories, they still are very flexible. They can move back and forth, and they do travel quite a bit, and they see what's happening in terms of rebuilding infrastructures in each of those sides, and they share those stories. So in the sense of who's helping, I think it's a very difficult and yet complex question. And the more what I've seen, at least on the Ukrainian-controlled territories, is that people try to help themselves, people helping others within their communities. And it's a very specific targeted help. So the idea of the law and justice above all, the idea of making sure that your local government is responsible for the roads that are broken or for the helping you to build new schools or medical facilities. There's a lot of the interest and hope that people themselves can do that. It's a very small group of activists right now, but I think they're very energetic and they very much want to build up. And that's how usually civic engagement and civil society starts building. And when you have a small group of individuals who are really passionate about the cause and who are ready to go all the way in to really make things better.
Well, I have to end on that notion of hope because we've got to find some way to have hope here. And so you yourself have been involved in some of these projects as a professor of public relations, strategic communication, your background in media. What are those things that you're hopeful about since you've been there? I mean, you've mentioned some of these small projects and you know, the number of activists and leaders that are coming up and that they're being supported by external funding maybe, but what is it that provides you hope about your home country?
I think one of the most important things is the durability and really resilience of the Ukrainians as the folks, as the people, and the idea that we always see the positive side and try to take care of your own neighbor and take care of your community is one big thing. And the other really big notion and change that really provides hope for me is the very fact that still, despite the facts that Ukraine is out from the front pages, there is still a big interest in Ukraine and understanding the essence of fight for independence and freedom that exists in the European Union. And the very fact that, for example, Ukrainians now can travel to European Union countries visa-free is the big step forward to really demonstrate the positive and of the reforms in Ukraine. Because the biggest challenge right now is to make reforms that Ukrainians try to pass in Kyiv, right? The Kyiv government is to demonstrate to the people who live in all different places around Ukraine how reforms really help you. And I think the more specific reforms can become, the better of Ukrainian hope will be.
Well, thank you, Katerina, for reminding us the importance of this country in the crossroads right there between Europe and Eurasia and two very important parts of the world. So thank you very much for being here today and shedding some light on that.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Oklahoma Public Relations and Strategic Communications Professor Katerina Tsatsura. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Berlide.